Okay, we're moving into our second hour, and we're going to be looking at Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 through 13. This is related to the church in Philadelphia. The word Philadelphia means brotherly love. Philos and Delphos are the two words there. So Philadelphia means brotherly love, and the city was located about 28 miles southeast of Sardis, and was actually named after a king by the name of Attalus Philadelphus. He was a former king of Pergamum. Now, the city was known for its pagan temples and was sometimes referred to as Little Athens. The city was also known for its earthquakes. Apparently, it was seated on a fault. And apparently it had some pretty severe earthquakes, most notably one which destroyed the city in 17 BC. And apparently the destruction of the city was so severe that many of the residents moved outside of the city for fear of another disaster. Now, I think that historical event plays into some of the things that Christ says in this particular church. Because these people, having moved out of the city, it would become a practice that they would have to come in the city, go out of the city, come in the city, go out of the city, and there would be this back and forth. And we have that today. I mean, we have people that live in the city, right? We have the urban dwellers, and then we have people that move outside in the suburbs and the rural area, and you move further and further out from the city proper. But the further out you go, well, further your commute is. I have a lady I work with who lives in Mansfield, and she has to drive to the office every day, and probably takes her anywhere between 50 minutes to an hour to get to work. And there was a nice little traffic jam, and traffic was narrowed down into one lane on 287, and she came into work a few days ago and took her about an hour and 45 minutes. Well, it's nice to live out in a rural area, but, you know, the commute can be pretty brutal at times. So anyway, we have this event that I think plays into some comments here in the church we'll see in a minute. This is one of the churches that does not receive a rebuke, by the way. He says here, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write," and again, the angel of the church here, I take it to be either the pastor or a spiritual leader in the church, somebody with authority in the church who can address these issues, but then he says, "He who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens," says this. So first of all, he starts off, he says, "He who is holy." And holy here translates the Greek word hagios, and it means sacred, holy, set apart. It speaks of the fact that as Christ, as God, that he is set apart from sin. So he who is holy, and then it says he who is true. Now true, the Greek word here, alethenos, can mean true as over against what is false, but I think here it has the idea of genuine or authentic. So when it says he who is holy and he who is true, holy would be different from that which is common, and genuine would be in contrast to that which is false. Because there were false religions, there were false deities that were worshipped, and here Christ presents himself as one who is holy and one who is true. So again, in contrast to many of the false gods that people worshipped. So it says, "He who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David." Now, what does it mean to have the key of David? Well, go back with me to Isaiah chapter 22, I think is where the allusion here is, or the reference. Isaiah 22, verses 20 through 22. And this, I think, is where this reference comes from. And it's God who gives somebody in Israel authority, somebody who is his servant. It says in Isaiah 22:20, "Then it will come about in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely around him. I will entrust him with your authority," that is, with the king's authority. So this Eliakim was somebody who had the authority basically to open the door, to close the door for anybody who wanted to come to the king, is the way I understand it. So if somebody wanted access to the king, well, they would have to go through Eliakim. So he was the person who basically opened the door or closed the door for such visits. So he says, "I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut, and when he shuts, no one will open." So it's basically he's the keeper of the gate. He's the one who has the authority here that is given to him by God. So when it says here that he who has the key of David, Christ here, is basically the one who has the authority. And it says, "Who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens," says this. Basically, Christ is presented as the one who controls opportunities. As the one who controls opportunities. And we'll talk about that more once we get towards the end of this lesson. He says, "I know your deeds." And again, this is a reference to his omniscience. "I know your deeds. Behold, I have put before you an open door." And the way I take this is that it is an open door here is an opportunity for ministry. Is what it is. He says, "I have put before you an open door which no one can shut." Which no one can shut. And then he makes a comment here. He says, "Because you have little power and have kept my word and have not denied my name," is what he's telling them. So he says, "I have put before you an open door which no one can shut." But when he says, "because you have little power," now there's two ways to understand that, two possible ways. One is that this open door, this opportunity for ministry, was open to them because they were weak. It was because they did not have the ability within themselves. And therefore, it is something that is accomplished by Christ and Christ alone. And I think of 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul talks about his thorn in the flesh and his weakness and how he doesn't like the messenger of Satan that's sent to buffet him. But once he understands the purpose of it, that it serves a purpose of keeping him humble, he says, "Most gladly, therefore, I will boast in my weakness that the power of Christ may dwell in me." So it could be a reference to the fact that they are weak, and therefore the emphasis is upon Christ and their reliance upon Christ for ministry, which is true for all of us because none of us have the ability within ourselves to be effective ministers. It is really Christ through us that we look to him continually. Or it could be that he has given them little power, that is, he has given them just enough strength to accomplish the ministry. In other words, the power that they have, however little it is, and it uses the word little here, translates the Greek word mikros. We get the word micro from it. But it's literally, they have little power, but however little it is sufficient for the need. Yes, ma'am.
And I don't know where he may get this, but he says, willpower, not because of spiritual weakness, but because of the few believers in the church. So this, to me, that doesn't even sound like he would fit in that thing.
It It could be. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure where he would get that from, because of the few. Well, they were not a large church. So it could be that's where he's deriving it from, that basically they were a small congregation. And so being a small congregation, they really didn't have a lot of people, a lot of manpower, and therefore they didn't have a lot of resources. So that might be the idea of where Ryrie's coming from with that. And I've heard that comment before. It's just not very commonplace from what I think, but he obviously included it in his footnote. But he says, I have put before you an open door, which no one can shut, because you have little power and have kept my word. So there was faithful obedience and have not denied my name. And I would take it that having not denied his name, in spite of public pressure. Because public pressure can weigh in upon us to silence us, or to get us to give lip service, to other organizations or to beliefs that may be contrary to Christianity. But he says, you have kept my word and have not denied my name. And then he says in verse 9, behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan. And this is the second time we've had a reference to the synagogue of Satan. And here it's a reference to Jewish unbelievers who were in league with Satan to oppose the gospel. The word synagogue translates the Greek, it's almost transliterated from the Greek word synagoge. And synagoge means to gather together, is what it means. So it's a gathering together of people, is what a synagogue is. It's just people who assemble together. But nonetheless, these are referred to as a gathering together of Satan, a people who gather together, but who are in league, as it were, with Satan. So these are, I take it to be a reference to Jewish unbelievers who oppose the gospel. He says, behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews, and in the way that they would use the term, they would be understood in the sense of God's true representatives, is how they would present themselves, who say they are Jews, but are not, and are not, but lie. He says, behold, I will make them come to you and bow down at your feet to know that I have loved you. Now, when he says again that who say they are Jews and are not, I think of the reference in Romans 9:6 where Paul says, not all Israel is Israel. In other words, not all biological descendants of Abraham who are national Israel are spiritual Israel. They're not Jews in the truest sense of ones who accept Jesus as Messiah. So when they say that they are Jews and are not, I take it in that sense. And he says, but lie. He says, behold, I will make them to come and bow down at your feet and to know that I have loved you. You know, we don't know of any historical reference where that occurred. It could be a reference to something future, where in Philippians 2, where it talks about how every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, it could be a reference to that future event, possibly. In verse 10, he says, because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I will also keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. Now, when he says, because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I will also keep you from the hour of testing. The hour of testing refers to the whole time of testing. And he describes it, he says, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world. So I take this to be a reference to the future tribulation, Revelation chapters 6 through 18. Because this isn't local tribulation, this is tribulation that comes upon the whole world. And the word whole translates the Greek word holos. Holos, H-O-L-O-S. We see it in the words like holocaust. You've heard the word holocaust, right? Well, that translates two words, holos, which means whole, and the word kausis, which means burning. And so whole here, holos, refers to the entire planet, the entire inhabited planet, is when he's talking about the whole world, to test those who dwell upon the earth. And then in verse 11, he says, I am coming quickly. That is, he's coming in a quick manner. That is, when he comes, it will happen suddenly. He says, hold fast what you have. In other words, be faithful. In order that no one take your crown. And the word crown translates the Greek word Stephanos. Stephanos, that's where I get my name, Stephen. And of course, we don't want anybody to take your Stephen, right?
Right.
Right. That's right. In order that no one take your crown. And Stephanos here is a reference to rewards, is what it is. It's a reference to rewards. And so he says in verse 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. And it was customary, not customary, but it was a custom at this time to where people would write the names of faithful citizens in the community, maybe like a plaque, but they would write their names on the temple pillars, what was considered a permanent structure in the city. And it could be the idea where we get the idea of like somebody who's like a pillar of the community, somebody who's an important part of the structure of the community, and to write their name on the temple pillar. But he says here, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And that comment that I made earlier about people coming in and out of the city could be an allusion to this here. That basically, once you're in the city of God, unlike your current city, you're not going to be going in and out. You're going to be able to dwell there securely, safely. So he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from God, and my new name. So he mentions three things that he will write upon him. Now, this might be the closest that we can think of as a tattoo, although I don't think we're literally going to have tattoos in heaven. But he says, and I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. When you're given a new name was a sign of ownership. And I think of when Adam, back in the Garden of Eden, gave names to all the animals. It was him exercising his authority over the creation. And by the way, we give names to things now. We name boats and houses and children, and you know, it's all a sign of ownership. And then he closes out with verse 13. It says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Let me read the summary here, and then we'll take some questions. So Jesus presents himself as the one who is holy and true, which means he is worthy to judge the church at Jerusalem. He is righteous.
Philadelphia.
I mean, in Philadelphia. Yeah. So being holy and true basically communicates that he is worthy to judge the church at Philadelphia. And he possesses the key of David, which means he has the authority to open and close doors of opportunity. Now he commends the Christians at Philadelphia for their deeds, saying, I have put before you an open door which no one can shut, because you have a little power and have kept my word and have not denied my name. Now, the Christians at Philadelphia were under Jewish persecution from unbelievers who had aligned with Satan and who had opposed the gospel message. To these, Jesus said, I will make them to come and bow down at your feet and to know that I have loved you. And as I mentioned when working through that passage, that this could be an allusion to a future judgment when all shall bow the knee in recognition of Jesus as Lord. Because of their faithfulness, Jesus promised, I also will keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. I have a quote here from John Walvoord from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. He says, "This is an explicit promise that the Philadelphia church will not endure the hour of trial which is unfolded, beginning in Revelation chapter 6. Christ was saying that the Philadelphia church would not enter the future time of trouble, and he could not have stated it more explicitly." And it's because of this verse and other passages in the New Testament that I take a pre-trib rapture. A pre-trib rapture, which a pre-trib rapture means that the church is caught out and does not go through the tribulation. Now, when we jumped into Revelation, we talked about different rapture views. There are some who hold to a mid-trib rapture view, that believes we go through the first 3.5 years. There are those who hold to a post-tribulation rapture view that says we go through the tribulation and then we're caught up to meet the Lord in the air and then come right back down with Him. There is also called a partial rapture view, which says that only faithful Christians are caught up in the rapture and carnal Christians will go through the go through the tribulation. And, you know, to me, the argument stands strongly in favor of a pre-trib rapture view. And we'll talk more about this, especially once we jump into Revelation chapter 4 and following. Because the church is not mentioned, you know, after Revelation chapter 4. As a matter of fact, Revelation chapter 4, Jesus says to John, "Come up here," and he's caught up to heaven. And to me, that's a picture of the church being caught up to heaven. And from that time onward, the church is not mentioned. Once you get into the time of the tribulation. So I think there's a great deal of evidence in support of that. Going back to the notes, when Jesus comes, he will come quickly and will reward faithful Christians. To those who overcome, Jesus promises, "I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God and my new name." And then I have a quote from Warren Wiersbe. He says, "The symbolism in this verse would be especially meaningful to people who lived in constant danger of earthquakes. The stability of the pillar, no need to go out or to flee, a heavenly city that nothing could destroy. Ancient cities often honored great leaders by erecting pillars with their names inscribed on them. God's pillars are not made of stone because there is no temple in the heavenly city. His pillars are faithful people who bear his name for his glory." And I thought that was a very good statement. I thought it, you know, warranted putting in the notes here. And then lastly, Christ closes out. He says, those who have ears to hear, let him hear, which again refers to those with capacity to hear, were to listen and comply with the words of Jesus.